Find Google and Wikipedia for facts and memories worth recounting. Now, I was sourcing material from grieving friends. I didn't know Rick well, but my coworkers did. They put plugs in for a favorite pet, a beloved pastime, or a small quirk. I sent in my draft, confident that Cody and the president would improve it, and yet still unsure whether the statement would do him justice. Like a snapshot grabbed at just the right moment. It just needed to capture him, I thought. Larry David? Antoinette's disdain was evident as she reacted to my email. Yeah, Larry David, I replied, miffed. I don't think so. I want this to be taken seriously. A close colleague and friend, Antoinette used a standing desk in our cramped office. I'd never given the standing much mind, but in this moment, as she cut down my suggestion, her adjustable Varidesk really pissed me off. How does that make sense? She added. I was incredulous. The exact reason I wrote, for lifting up the little things and bringing the country together around a show about nothing. She was baffled. For the Presidential Medal of Freedom? At this point, Desiree turned to me. Red zone. Each year, the president awards the medal, the nation's highest civilian honor, to individuals who, according to the White House, have made especially meritorious contributions to the security or national interests of the United States, to world peace, or to cultural or other significant public or private endeavors. Simple enough. White House staff members were given the opportunity to weigh in on the list of selections. We could offer up individuals we deemed worthy of the honor, to then be whittled down and eventually selected by the president. To me, the cultural endeavors, and especially the other language, is broad and open to interpretation, as evidenced by former honorees Lucille Ball and Stevie Wonder. That's why I put forward the Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm star. But others took a different route. You mean to tell me that Larry David deserves the Medal of Freedom more than Malala Yousafzai? A young Pakistani woman who stood up to the Taliban and earned a Nobel Peace Prize, somebody asked. Or Rosa Parks, somebody else added. My deskmate picked up her red pen as I readied my response. Can't he deserve it as much? I joked. Tally mark. And so close to Black History Month, Desiree chimed in as she took pen to post it. Double tally mark. Dude, we're way clear of Black History Month, I protested jokingly, consulting the calendar. Another tally mark. This made 5 in one morning. That long, assertive strike across the previous 4 meant that Larry's hopes for a medal were slipping away. So were my hopes for reconnecting with Larry, whom I hadn't seen since he nearly run me over on Martha's Vineyard 2 summers before. Truth is, I had recently written a pilot for a political comedy about America's first man, inventively titled First Man. The script had gotten a bit of attention in Hollywood, but no offers. So it's possible my Larry nomination was clouded by personal admiration of what he's achieved. Still, I genuinely felt it appropriate to honor America's favorite misanthrope and a brilliant storyteller. On the afternoon of the 13th, a couple of film producers, Tim White and Matt George, dropped by the White House for what we called a rogue tour, a quick, non-sanctioned look around the West Wing. They were producing Rob Reiner's film LBJ, who had met months earlier as they scouted the White House. Tim, who would quickly go on to major success in Hollywood with Steven Spielberg's The Post, was working with me on First Man, and even more interested in politics than I was. We offered official West Wing tours in the evenings after 7:30, but they were a whole thing to organize and, of course, meant staying well after 7:30. So the better option for folks who had offices or desks in the West Wing was to simply bring in guests to visit where we work, and then in a just-so-happen kind of way, to pass by the Oval Office, the Cabinet Room, the Roosevelt Room, and the Briefing Room. That was my plan for the producers, but things were off to a rocky start when Rodas, receptionist of the United States, called me into the West Wing lobby and reminded me that I needed to wait with them because Matt, who was originally from Australia, had a pink badge. The Secret Service provides color-coordinated badges to guests, press, and staff. Those born outside of the United States are given pink badges and require an escort at all times when moving around the campus. Matt wondered why he was adorned with a pink badge, and because I think the whole foreign national thing is rude, I told him it was because he was wearing jeans. There's a similar hierarchy of badges among White House staff. You wear either a blue or a green badge. Interns get light blue and press wear red. I was given a blue badge when I made the move from media monitor to the West Wing. Green grants you access to the EEOB, while blue means you can go wherever you want, West Wing included. It's a silly split, and many people much more important than I was sat across the street wearing green. On this afternoon, the president was running behind, and had not yet left the Oval Office for an event on the state floor of the mansion, so we waited in the main West Wing lobby, which is the formal entrance and exit point for White House visitors whose appointments are not meant to be kept a secret. As soon as the president left his desk, with the help of one of the president's bodymen, I was going to sneak both producers into the Oval for a quick peek around. But before we could, the door to the Roosevelt Room opened and out walked the vice president and former Secretary of State James Baker. Have I mentioned that the vice president is a close talker? A very close talker. It was hard to tell whether he and the secretary were debating foreign policy or about to go in for a kiss. As the vice president headed for his office, Secretary Baker shouted about their recent meetings on foreign policy implications of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. Now this is a big fucking deal! Thank God my mother isn't around to hear that, the vice president shot back. At this point, I realized two things. My guests were getting a pretty solid rogue tour, and I hadn't checked my BlackBerry in about 5 minutes, which is about 4 minutes too many. After typing my password, usually hoagie and a number, I saw a flurry of unread emails about an ongoing situation in Paris. Each email was made up of copy and pasted tweets from our media monitor to the entire communications department, as well as senior advisors and the chief of staff and his deputies. Something about a shooting, maybe in multiple locations. The producers' eyes nearly popped out of their heads as Henry Kissinger, Madeleine Albright, and Colin Powell made their way out of the Roosevelt Room and passed us, but I was focused on my phone. More tweets flooded my inbox. I told Tim and Matt that whatever was going on in Paris was turning into something real. You get pretty good reading thousands of headlines and tweets per day at determining what's about to be a major story, about what matters and what doesn't. We were only a few minutes in, but this seemed huge and horrific. It seemed like it was going to matter for a long time. And sure enough, as Secretary of Defense Ash Carter filtered out of the Roosevelt, the Situation Room sent a blast email about the attack on Paris. That's the way it typically worked at the White House. Unfolding tragedy, revealed through a gush of tweets, punctuated by emails from the Situation Room. Often they were false alarms. As we know, this was not. Still, it wasn't entirely clear yet what was happening in Paris, and as the president made his way to the state floor, we hurried to the Oval, where Tim and Matt took in Barack Obama's office. I hung in the outer Oval Office. Pete was there. The statement on his friend had gone out a few hours earlier, and he thanked me for helping with it. He said he thought it would mean a great deal to the family. Josh arrived to wait in the outer as Tim and Matt finished exploring the Oval Office. Evidently, the attack in Paris had reached a level where it might be appropriate for the president to speak publicly on the issue. Josh needed to get word from President Obama that he agreed that was the right course before alerting the press to expect something. For these types of quickly pulled together statements, which were usually in response to varying degrees of national or international tragedy, we used the Brady Press briefing room because it required minimal setup. The cameras are ready to go 24 hours per day, and the presidential seal takes only seconds to hang on the permanent podium. We allowed about a half hour for those members of the press who are off campus to rush in. As Josh continued to wait for the president to return, we moved into the cabinet room, which is adjacent to the outer Oval Office. Every member of the president's cabinet, from the small business administrator to the Secretary of State, has his or her own brown leather chair, each slightly shorter than the president's seat, that bears his or her title on the back. Following a cabinet member's tenure, he or she is offered the opportunity to purchase the chair. As a fall afternoon turned to evening, we looked at the colonnade and into the darkened rose garden, through a series of four matching glass doors, windows onto the president's path. I rattled off a few additional useless facts for Tim and Matt. I was never very good at giving tours. I didn't appropriately memorize the facts and figures. But by 2015, I'd been around long enough to feel more comfortable leading folks, mostly friends and family, around the building. Felt like I belonged. But even as I mined my limited repertoire of White House information for my guests, my mind was elsewhere, worried about what news might pop into my BlackBerry next. We heard a commotion and watched as Secret Service agents scurried on the other side of the doors, a telltale sign that Renegade was on the move. It was getting dark this night of November 13th, but before long, the president strode by slowly, as clear as day. He was alone, or as alone as he ever is. He looked increasingly serious with each frame he occupied. It was like I was watching a movie reel. He was silhouetted as he crossed their final frame, an oddly cinematic moment in front of these two film producers, who had just wrapped a movie that included a set with a reconstructed version of the very area where we were standing. Shortly after my friends left, it was obvious. The shootings in Paris were coordinated. It was a terrorist attack. The president made his way past upper press, through lower press, and into the briefing room, where he announced, "This is an attack not just on Paris. It's an attack not just on the people of France, but this is an attack on all of humanity and the universal values that we share." It was filmic language, but this wasn't Michael Douglas, and we weren't on the set of Tim and Matt's movie. This was the unreal meeting the very real. But that's the way of the White House, from silly to serious in an instant, from a presidential pep talk to the passing of a friend, from Larry David to Henry Kissinger, and a president who spent his morning celebrating a remarkable year with a small team, and his evening mourning a tragedy with the world. I guess that's why Tony Snow said, "The White House, with all its pressures, intrigues, triumphs, betrayals, joys, and disappointments, is the most special place you will ever work." Hell, it was the only place I had really ever worked. But walking out late that night, on my way home to eat Oreos and watch House Hunters, I knew he was right. There I was, back where I started the day, on the sidewalk with the other folks, and as I looked up at that grand place, a little less mysterious to me now, but no less glorious, I glanced at my glowing phone. Pete had forwarded me a note that knocked me back. It was from his friend's daughter, who wrote of the president's statement on her father, "It's so perfect, that's my dad." So while humbling isn't the word I would use to describe walking into the White House, maybe that's exactly what walking out of it is. A year and a half later, I walked out of those gates one final time, humbled for a whole host of reasons. It was dark, a bit dreary, and very quiet. I was wearing my tan summer suit, my nod to the nonsense. But in the January darkness, my thoughts turned to the more meaningful, briefly beyond the here and now. On his first day in office, a year and a half before I arrived, President Obama sent a note to his staff. He wrote, "However long we are keepers of the public trust, we should never forget that we are here as public servants, and public service is a privilege. Public service is, simply and absolutely, about advancing the interests of the American people." I told you I'm a worrier. Tend to wish or worry away the weekend. What's next, I too often wonder most moments. On Memorial Day, I'll lament, "Summer's over." I'll fret a vacation's close as soon as I land. But that didn't happen at the White House. I had this sense that it wasn't going to end. That we were on some endless loop. That this was home, my coworker's family. It's partly why things hit me so hard when it ended the way it did. And it's why I still feel like I'm on a long vacation. That any day I'll throw on my suit, trek down the streets of D.C., past Lafayette Park, and into those imposing gates. Leaving the last time, I was uneasy. I hadn't wished away my time, but did I appreciate it? I didn't know that as I trudged up the EEOB steps at 22 years old, my parents absurdly yet sweetly watching from beyond the fence, that I wouldn't walk out until I was 29, that this place would help define me. Dan Pfeiffer did two things before he left the White House. First, he came into upper press one night, only this was a different Dan, a nervous Dan. For a moment, our roles were reversed. He sidled up to a free desk next to Hallie's, anxious to tell me something. He and Hallie were dating. Stephanie and my family often remind me that I can be dense, but I had thought I had my pulse on this place better than this. I was shocked, in the best possible way, to learn about this budding presidential romance, brewing unbeknownst to me. Suddenly, his frequent visits to upper press to make small talk, even after he moved across the hall to senior advisor, made more sense. Theirs wasn't the only relationship forged in the White House. I would attend Dan and Hallie's wedding, along with plenty of other staffers who met their husbands and wives through President Obama. Josh met his wife Natalie on the campaign. They had their first date the Saturday after Inauguration Day. Marie met her husband Andrew while working for Vice President Biden. Bobby met his wife Ellen through Obama too. Cody had his speeches rigorously fact-checked by a woman named Kristen, who would become his wife. Clark and Caroline, Obama spokespeople who are now married, met in lower press. And Matt and Stephanie, a talented White House researcher who had gone to work at the State Department, found each other and got married as well. I thought back to my own wedding, on a balmy July evening in downtown Philadelphia. Like most surreal events, I now see my wedding through a series of flashes. What I saw, stories I heard, that congeal to form a sense of the night. Stephanie turning the corner of the aisle with her dad. My inability to get through the ceremony, crying from the moment I saw her until we both said, I do. My brother Alex, in his tux with the bridesmaids, leaping into the fountain at Logan Circle, and then demanding, dripping wet, that the receptionist call Taylor Swift, who was apparently staying on our floor. Marie and Antoinette presenting me with a framed photo of my engagement in the Rose Garden, with a note from the president. My dad's moving speech told in bicycle terms, and my pop-up dancing in his seersucker suit. I thought about the faces of the people, my family, and lifelong friends, dancing alongside so many guests, my White House family, who were unknown to me just a few years before. Young people I didn't grow up with from across the country, who came together around an idea, embodied in a skinny guy with a funny name from the south side of Chicago. They weren't friends I had my whole life, but that didn't matter, because you get to know people quickly in the White House, where stress is high, days are long, and everything's accelerated in the foxhole. Seeing the different people from disparate parts of our lives come together to party was one of the most rewarding facets of our wedding. We didn't look alike, hadn't grown up in the same way, but my White House family and I had something important in common, highlighted by Dan, the second thing he did before he left the White House. I read hundreds of obligatory goodbye emails from departing staff during my years at the White House, but something Dan wrote stood out. He said that no matter where we went or how many years passed, we would forever be known as Obama people. I took comfort in that as I walked out of the gates for the last time. I thought about a million little moments, asking Matt, what's a POTUS, getting red zoned, that absurd photo of me on a horse in the ocean, regularly circulated by Vels and others. Swing states and debates. I thought about Susan Rice opening that horse email and Josh replying to the whole White House, giddy up. The thrill of 2012, proposing to Stephanie in the Rose Garden, Lester Holt at Nelson Mandela's funeral, the despair of 2016, bringing my mom and dad, Stephanie, Harry, and Alex, into the Oval Office to meet the president, the Pope sneeze and Seinfeld squeaking sneaks, Shaq. I thought about walking my Nana and my pop-up through the West Wing before they could no longer travel, the door of no return, watching an inauguration from the Atlantic Ocean, then the Blue Room. These were the moments that marked my time winging it, West winging it. After all, a presidency is defined by a series of moments, for better or worse. Some of those moments flashed through my mind, signing the Affordable Care Act into law, SEAL Team 6 and a red line in Syria, reaching over the sneeze guard at Chipotle, a baseball game in Cuba, a beer summit in Trayvon Martin, announcing that America would wind down two wars, wearing a tan suit, an attack in Paris, Amazing Grace in Charleston, and Aurora and Newtown in Orlando. Hope and hard-won change. But I was drawn to the quieter moments as I drew closer to the gates one last time. I thought back to 5 years earlier, when I had wrangled my first late-night Marine One arrival. In the middle of the night, the White House takes on a haunting, midnight melancholy. Stillness replaces frenzy. Suddenly from above, three points of light, Marine One and its two decoy helicopters, become visible from the South Lawn. Watching the chopper carrying our 44th president throttle past the glowing monument to our first president, I was struck by the thought, one day Obama will be a monument. That same idea would occasionally pop into my mind in the Oval Office. I'm talking to a battleship, likely a bridge too, an international airport, as well as countless future high schools. But for now, he was the person landing before me on his backyard. The strong winds of Marine One leave an impression, but at once, you're confident everything will be all right. Obama bounds up the South Lawn across the drive and into the dip room. The doors close behind him, and the helicopter, no longer Marine One, lifts away into the night. The stillness returns, and the anxieties of the world seem to hold in abeyance until the sun peaks over the tidal basin by Jefferson, when the White House comes back to life. By the time the sun reaches the top of Washington, the day is in full swing. And as the sun sinks beyond Lincoln, calm sets back in. I think about Obama people, about Granite and Grace and generations to come, their kids, my kids, as today's Obama people become tomorrow's Obama family, and we expand beyond the gates of the White House. I think about monuments, how they remember people and events, and I think about those kids who might stop by an Obama monument many White Houses from now. They may not see it at first, but if they look closely, somewhere in the smallest veins of the granite will be the people who worked there, winged it there, laughed there, fell in love there, cried there, and served there. On January 17th, 2017, as the iron gates locked into place behind me for the final time, my blue badge gone, I thought back to Antoinette's overly earnest, corny-as-hell daily goodbye. It's been a pleasure serving the American people with you. Yes, it had been. Epilogue. Of the end. She's not going to get there. A lump formed in my throat the instant I heard it, but I was determined not to cry. Okay, then. The West Wing was emptying out, and I thought it was time to leave. The party was over. I departed the White House grounds knowing that walking into work would never be the same, but unwilling to grapple with what it all meant at midnight. A crowd had gathered on Pennsylvania Avenue. Somebody asked me if they had called it. I yelled back, no, and kept moving. Typically, I'll check my work phone 10 times in the brief time it takes to walk home, but I had nothing to look at this night. Both phones dead. I peered creepily into somebody's window from the sidewalk to see if the worst had become official, but all I could make out were the blues and too much red of election night coverage. I kept moving. It was unseasonably warm. I slapped myself hard on the cheek, which I regretted immediately as cliche. I was relieved to find that the election had not yet been called when I arrived home. The campaign granted a stay of execution. Stephanie, still in her Hillary t-shirt, and I watched John Podesta, who used to pop in and out of Upper Press often, walk into frame. He asked the group of thousands assembled under the glass ceiling of Manhattan's Jacob Javits Center to head home. The day after the election, we woke up to a gloomy, rainy day. It was fitting, but also a bit much, like we were living a movie with a lazy script. In the basement of the West Wing, I heard a White House aide plead facetiously with a counterterrorism staffer, "Please tell me it was the Russians." I wasn't ready for the gallows humor, and remained stoic until my mom called. She had won big the night before, but I heard her crying on the other line. Aubrey had just called her on the way to preschool. Aubrey liked to imitate Trump by shouting, blah, 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 blah. She had seized on his lack of substance and took her imitation to anyone who would listen. She even delivered the spot-on impression to the Clintons after asking about trash in the park. They were delighted. "We've got to get you on TV," President Clinton said with a smile. I loved the Trump impression, but I was ready to be done with it, to move on from his candidacy. So was Aubrey, who had wanted to talk to her grandmother as soon as she heard the news about Donald. She was confused and upset, but still, she was sure it would be okay. Hillary can win next year, right? She thought that in part a presidential race was like a regular race. Hillary just ran a little slower than Donald last night. I choked back tears thinking of the eternal hope and brightness of a child as I filtered into Josh's office with dozens of other shell-shock staffers. We were back where we had begun to celebrate the night before. Jen Psaki reminded us of the important work that lay ahead, and Cody previewed the remarks he had worked on with the president, to be delivered in the cabinet room. The president's assistant, Ferial, dropped in and asked for Josh. A moment later, she was back. "The president would like to see all of you in the Oval Office." I've given countless White House tours for friends and family, most of whom comment on how small and cramped everything is. Not so with the Oval, where the drab carpet of the West Wing gives way to beautiful hardwood, and a rug with the president's favorite quotes emblazoned along the outer edge. The light is brilliant, crisp. Our group of communication staffers, from the press secretary down to the media monitor, made our way in. For some, this was their first time in the Oval Office. We spread out along the edge of the room, and I took my place between Kennedy's "No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings," and Roosevelt's "The welfare of each of us is dependent fundamentally upon the welfare of all of us." President Obama began to speak, but staffers kept filtering in. He punctured the tension, calling the procession like a clown car. He and the vice president stood in front of the Resolute desk. The president started again. He talked about hope and about the importance of doing things the right way, now more than ever. "This is not the apocalypse," he said. The vice president shook his head. I had seen this format before, even set it up myself sometimes. The president speaking, with the vice president at his side, reaffirming with a smile or underscoring the importance of the moment with a nod. We used its powerful effect throughout the presidency. I hadn't ever been its intended audience, though. "This is not the apocalypse." At this point, I broke down. This was not the poise sniffling that the moment called for. I was full-blown ugly crying in the Oval Office as the president gave us a pep talk. I was upset for my niece, who didn't understand that Hillary couldn't win in a year, and for my mom, who worked so hard on Hillary's behalf, and for my wife, who wore her Hillary shirt to work and around town, and for my Nana, who thought she would finally see a woman president. I was selfishly upset for myself. This wasn't how it was supposed to end. I hadn't even begun to think about the people across the country, the vulnerable, the disadvantaged, the different, for whom a Trump presidency could have real, tangible effects. Still, the president highlighted something that Ben Rhodes, who was standing off to the side, had emailed him when the outcome seemed clear the night before. "History doesn't move in a straight line. It zigs and zags." In the Oval, desperately trying to compose myself in front of my Obama family, this was a hard zag. I had to turn away to try to get it together. The president reminded us that most of the folks in the room were young, and that this was just our first rodeo, that we had known only winning. But hope is called for most in our losses. Then he said that he didn't want to do the televised speech in the cabinet room. He looked to the windows. The rain had stopped. "Look, it's sunny out," he said, and suggested he give the speech in the Rose Garden. It was more optimistic. He asked if we agreed. Yes, we did.
West Winging It, an unpresidential memoir, was written and read by Pat Canaan. It was recorded by Julian Nicholson at the Invisible Studios in Los Angeles, with editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Elliot Rombach. West Winging It was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. West Winging It, an unpresidential memoir, is available in print from Gallery Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.